What's the difference between limitations and brokenness? What does it mean to be blessed? How can a dual diagnosis of Down syndrome and autism be a part of a flourishing life? I'm Amy Julia Becker, and this is Reimagining the Good Life, a podcast about challenging the assumptions about what makes life good, proclaiming the inherent belovedness of every human being, and envisioning a world of belonging. Today, I get to talk with my friend Micah Boyette, who's also the author of a beautiful new book, Blessed Are the Rest of Us. Micah is a fantastic writer. If you don't already subscribe to her newsletter, The Slow Way, I would highly recommend that you push pause right now and do so. The link is in the show notes. She's also a podcast host for The Lucky Few, one of my favorite podcasts, and honestly, the go-to podcast for parents of kids with Down syndrome. Micah lives with her husband and three children in northern New Jersey, and she works part-time as a youth pastor. She is a poet and a writer and just a beautiful human being. I'm so glad she's here with us today. One more note before we get started. I do have space in my live virtual workshop, Reimagining Family Life with Disability. So if this episode leaves you asking questions about how your family can live a life of flourishing, this workshop is a perfect place to work through the messages our culture tells us about disability and to make a manageable, supported plan forward towards a good future. I would love to have you with us. And please tell your friends about this opportunity. I know some of you are not parents of children with disability, and I'm so glad you're here. But I also imagine that you have people in your life who you could maybe invite into this space that is safe and hopeful. We already have people signed up from all over the nation, a few from across the globe. I'm really excited. I would love for you to be there, and you can find out more at amyjuliabecker.com/workshop or go to the link in the show notes. Okay, now to today's episode with Micah Boyette. Micah, I'm so glad that you're here.
Thanks, Amy Julia. I'm so glad to be here with you. And we've had so many good conversations over the years, and it's always been such a delight to like share this very particular experience of the world, having a child with Down syndrome. And I just love the way that you think about it and the way you write about it. And so it's a real pleasure to be here with you. And I love your podcast. I listen every week.
Oh, thank you. And actually, for listeners to this podcast, Micah is also a podcast host in her own right of The Lucky Few. So we have gotten to be on each other's podcasts in the past. And we'll link to some of those conversations in the show notes, both Micah being here before and me being there, because if you enjoy this conversation, maybe you'll like some of those too. And I thought, because we do have such a history of walking together and talking together and all of these things, I wanted to start with this conversation with the title of your book, because it was one of those where I thought this both sums up so much and it sends my thoughts in all these different directions about blessing and limits and longings and wholeness. And I want to cover all of those topics, but at the same time, at the very end of the book, in the acknowledgments, you write about some writing friends who helped you recognize that this was not only a memoir or only a reflection on this part of the Bible that I want you to talk about, but it was actually both. And so I would thought that maybe we could start by asking you to tell us about your son, Ace, and tell us about the Beatitudes. And some people might not know what I mean when I say the words, the Beatitudes. And then tell us how and why Ace and the Beatitudes have come together in this book.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you about Ace. When this comes out, he'll be 9 years old. So as we record, he's almost there. He's a kid whose favorite thing in the world is jumping on the trampoline. Also, second to that is probably dried mango, his favorite food in the world. He loves swimming and wrestling with his brothers and swinging and music. And he also has a dual diagnosis of Down syndrome and autism, which has become a pretty complicated concoction for him. He's non-speaking. And he has struggled not just to find communication through his voice, but to find forms of communication that work for him outside of speech. We've signed with him his whole life, and that's been really hard for him to grab onto. He uses an iPad device, which he's slowly starting to use, but we've been working on it for 4 years. So there's a lot going on. And it, you know, there's just things that hold back his communication, like motor planning and being able to attend to the world around him. And so there's that going on with him. But at the same time, he is like this, he's kind of magical in his ability to be present and like to find delight in the world and show how he feels. He can show us love and show us his anger, and it feels, both feel right, you know, both feel real in a way that a lot of my experiences with people, and even like my other kids, I can see us posing. I can see us leaning into personas. That doesn't exist for Ace. And it's, his presence with me is like powerful because he's wholly himself. And I feel like I'm always kind of in this back and forth space of like working with all my heart and time and resources to help him build skills so that he can thrive in like this brutal world that demands us to communicate, that demands that we live up to these expectations of ability. And also like his presence reminds me that there's an alternative world. And, you know, in the book I talk about, I use two different phrases. I use Stephanie Speller's phrase, God's dream for the world. I use Richard Rohr's phrase also, the really real. And when I'm using those, I'm thinking about this alternative way of living where our weaknesses are actually the truest things about us, as opposed to the other way that most of us live, where the truest things about us are what we can do. And that's how the world judges us. So, you know, I think I'm always kind of thinking about, and as I've raised him, I've come back over and over to like, how do we create this alternative world where the non-speaking, non-literate boy who wants to jump on the trampoline all day, where he's the most important among us? Mm-hmm. And what does that look like? So that's kind of what brought me to the Beatitudes in the first place, was that after he was born, I just kind of kept thinking and thinking and thinking of like, what do I believe about what his life means? What is my, like, what is the most solid and true definition of what it means to be human? And I think at these different points of realizing even that his development wasn't going to go the way of many people with Down syndrome who, you know, most people with Down syndrome start speaking at a certain, maybe later than most typical children, but there's a lot of opportunities to live independently in the world. And when those things haven't come for Ace, I think I've gone more and more into like, you know, like you, I think, and we've talked about this, Amy Julia, like the Amy Julia to all our listeners was there for me when she's the first person I called when I got my prenatal diagnosis. We were already friends and praise God because you were there for me that day when I needed you and onward. But I think that in those early days, you are given a diagnosis of Down syndrome, and the things that people say to you, or like the pamphlets you're handed, or whatever it is, in our culture right now, as people are trying to give like a more positive their positive experiences of Down syndrome. I was told a lot like it's going to be okay because people with Down syndrome can go to college.
You know,
people with Down syndrome can get married. People with Down syndrome are, you know, look, this woman's a lobbyist and this person ran a marathon. And I think there's still, like, you just kind of adjust your barometer mm-hmm. of here's what, you know, maybe my son won't do this, but he can do this. And I think the gift that has come with being like, oh, I'm grieving again. Like, I grieved this first time, but now there's an autism diagnosis. Now there's like the speech therapist telling me that maybe he will never speak. You know, now there's each thing that has happened. I've had to go further into this, into my, what do I believe makes him valuable? And it's not just turning down the dial of like, well, he's still valuable because someday he may, you know, be the first, what, you know, person with Down syndrome to do whatever. But like, he is valuable in his limits, even because of his limits. And so what does that mean? And so I just kept coming back to the Beatitudes because I think I began to find my footing there. Because it always comes back to limits and longing. And those are the two words that I see over and over in the Beatitudes, in this portion of Jesus's teaching. So now that I got there, what are the Beatitudes?
Yeah. Tell me about the Beatitudes.
So Jesus's longest documented sermon is the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And he starts the sermon out with this, you know, I call it a poem. I think there's probably theologians who would debate me on that. And I'm no theologian, so I'm just
going to call it. But you are a poet. So
I am a poet, so there. So Jesus kind of uses this structure that was pretty common in that day among Greco-Roman virtue, like oratorians. What are they called?
Orators. I think they're just orators.
Orators. Okay. and in that kind of structure where these thinkers would stand up and speak to crowds and say, the good life is. Mm. And then they would like list, like, this is what the good life is. Someone who's honest, someone who, you know, follows this kind of truth. And so they would list these virtues. And so Jesus is taking that structure and he's kind of turning it on his head before he starts this sermon that will really like set the foundation for what his ministry is going to be and how he's going to teach and the kind of example he's going to be of who God is. And instead of saying, basically, here's how to be good, which is what the virtue tradition was doing, Jesus is saying, here, all of you who are suffering, like, you've already got it. You've already got the good life. Now let's think about that. And so I came to these words, like, you know, it starts with the poor in spirit, the meek, like these people, the people who don't have power.
Yeah.
And I would think about Ace when I thought about the poor in spirit and the meek, like those who aren't impressive to the outside world. And then it would circle back to me because every time that I had a longing for Ace and it would look like, oh, we're not getting there. This is not the story right now. There would be this grief and I felt like I was in this kind of cycle of grief and then being like, nope, I'm not feeling that. We're going back to therapy. You know, like I'm going to make Ace be safe in this world. And the way to make him be safe is to get him to figure this out. Mm. And when that was a longing, it was this yearning. And, you know, I was just listening to this interview with, is it Nick Cave, the musician, with Krista Tippett. And he was talking about yearning and grief and how they are so interconnected and how that's the human experience for all of us. I have a particular kind of grief that I've lived through in longing for things for Ace.
Yeah.
But everybody has some kind of grief. Where, and you live long enough and we will grieve and we'll grieve and we'll grieve.
Yeah.
And that ache I felt for Ace's lack of power, I just began to see us both in the Beatitudes so clearly, and coming back to the fact that, like, Jesus starts his whole ministry by saying, this is what it means to flourish, to have the good life, to be whole. And if I'm finding myself there and I'm finding Ace there, then there's something deep that God is doing in both of us through that passage.
So I'm thinking about people who've, like, read the Beatitudes and are familiar with them, which is probably most people, even if you're not from a Christian tradition. There is they're somewhat of a cultural reference even now. And the word that I at least grew up with hearing the Beatitudes was blessed, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who mourn. And you pick up on that word in the title of your book, right? Blessed are the rest of us. And so I'd love to hear a little bit of just a reflection on blessing. Like, when you use the word blessed, what do you mean? What do you think Jesus meant? You have I'm going to add one more little piece to this question, because on page 32, you write about how the word blessed is a word that you've removed from your daily life. Mm-hmm. Because it was such a spiritually rosy coded notion, you say, and you say, I stopped believing that a long time ago. But then later on, you actually call Ace blessed, not just that his life is valuable, but like that there's actually a blessing to it. So I just would love for you to, like, explain what you mean and what you think Jesus means by that.
Yeah. I do feel like the word blessed is so fraught for me. And I think for a lot of us, I think, even though it's in the title, I think I spend a lot of the book saying, let's not call it blessed. Let's call it something else. And I found, like, even as I found this, like, kindred connection with the Beatitudes, I struggled with Jesus using that word blessed. You know, I kind of joke in the book about hashtag blessed and how it stands for everything. Like hashtag blessed, I got a good parking spot and I have helpful children, you know, and like we got a new house with a 3-car garage. Mm-hmm. We're obviously blessed. You know, I found it on a pair of pajamas and TJ Maxx. Yeah. So I think that what we usually mean when we say blessed is that we're fortunate and that good things have happened to us. And I think that that's why the Beatitudes is confusing for people.
I mean, because it's almost the opposite. Like, in terms of what Jesus is saying, like, our popular usage, even in, like, Christian or spiritual circles, is almost like the direct opposite of what it seems Jesus must be getting at. And that is where I do think that you're calling this, like, the good life belongs to, or the flourishing life is helpful for me in terms of being like, okay, wait, this is not just blessed. Yeah, this is not only hashtag blessed that we're talking about.
That's the danger of the Beatitudes, is that people read it as a transaction, that there's sort of this, if you're poor in spirit, you will be blessed. Like, something is good is going to happen to you because of it. Or, like, if you grieve, there will be some sort of magical surprise that comes from it. Or your life's going to get better somehow. And or like, if you long for justice, then God's going to be happy with you enough to give you what you want. And so this transactional nature is not, I think that's the problem with that word blessed and the way we think about it. So one of the things that really opened the passage up for me during my research was finding Jonathan Pennington's book, The Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing. And he's the one who introduced me to this idea of the Greco-Roman virtue poets and how these speeches, every time the speaker would take this notion of they would always be talking about the good life. Mm-hmm. Here's what it is to be whole. Here's what it is to flourish as a human. Yeah. And so, you know, we could kind of go into the Greek, but I think The case that Pennington makes is that it is an appropriate translation for us to say whole or flourishing are the ones who are poor in spirit. Whole and or flourishing are the ones who are meek. And to think about it in that way. And I think as we do, the Beatitudes become less transactional and more compassionate, more Jesus seeing the people in front of him in the moment and naming the pain he saw and saying, you're in the middle of God bringing you to wholeness.
Mm-hmm. So here's a question I have, I think, related to that. So I was noticing the verb tense in the Beatitudes for anyone who does not have them in front of them. I think this is correct. The opening and closing lines are in the present tense. Like it says, blessed are, and then it says, for these people, theirs is the kingdom of God, like present tense.
Yeah.
And then I think all the ones in the middle are future tense, like blessed are these people because they will be satisfied, comforted, shown mercy, that kind of thing. So they're like two different verb tenses, is and will be.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how you think about it. Like, do you think Jesus is saying, you are blessed here and now, or blessing will come someday? Again, like I really want to get away from that transactional understanding of the Beatitudes, or even just an understanding that this is only for the future.
Yeah.
Like I do think there are promises embedded throughout like God's relationship with humanity that have not been fully realized. And yet I also, and I wonder if you have this experience with Ace, I also think there is something true about saying no right now, even in the midst of the mourning, even in the midst of the, you know, grief that you've experienced along the way or the hardship. There is something that is like whole and flourishing and good even there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, this is very Enneagram 4 of me, but I just have no problem saying that it's both and.
Yeah.
That we are living at the intersection of like this moment in time when we believe that all things will be made new, and we also can see the really real and God's dream for the world, like being made manifest in the present moment. So, and I think Jesus lived at that intersection too. You know, he said the kingdom of God is at hand. And he also said the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed. Mm-hmm. Like it's in its present form, it's here right now. And it looks like one thing. And then there will be a time when it is a flowering plant.
Mm-hmm.
And both are true.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that probably culturally it was maybe easier for him to flow back and forth between those two realities in a way that it's harder for us living now to accept. But I think it's problematic when we choose one or the other. Like he's obviously talking about heaven because these people are suffering and they're not going to stop suffering in anytime soon to get the blessing. So the blessing is later. Or this like present tense that can also feel mean. Like, you know, like don't worry, you're blessed. You're fine.
Yes.
Like I know you're grieving, but it's if you really love God, then you should be you should be experiencing spiritual transformation. So there's, I think we need both things. And I think that there's like somehow, I mean, this is so hard for me to put words to, and I don't know if I quite can get there in the book, but there's this way that our limits and longings live in the core of us. And there's this other way where we live in this outside shell most of our lives, and that what suffering and struggle does for us is like move us down into the core so that we can really reckon with what's true about life and God and love. And I think that is our way into the flourishing life, even as we believe like this this side of the flourishing life is the mustard seed side, and there's another side that's like the plant.
There are these moments in the book where you also give us a vision of the plant, which I think is what Jesus does too. I'm thinking about some scenes there's a scene between Ace and your oldest son, August, mm-hmm. where you and August have gotten into a fight, and then Ace comes in, and I can't remember what age he is at this time, mm-hmm. but he just like puts his body next to August and loves him. Like it's just mm-hmm. this really tender scene. And I don't know. I mean, maybe there are some people who would see that scene and say that's still the mustard seed in the sense of, you know, there are no words spoken or, Ace is still so little, or I don't know. But for me, that's the plant. Like that's mm-hmm. the flourishing, blooming, beautiful. I think it was in my book, White Picket Fences, where I spent some time kind of asking or thinking about like, what does it mean to be created in the image of God, mm-hmm. and landing on the place of it means the capacity to love and be loved, mm-hmm. that is at its core, like what it means. And so that image of like Ace loving August in that moment to me seems like the flourishing plant, yes. so to speak.
Yeah. I think that's the notion that I want to get across about who Ace is and how he does invite us into like this different way of being alive is the moments like that where I don't know what it is. Like the Holy Spirit, like mm-hmm. he was 2 years old, barely walking. I was having a panic attack in the hallway and was not present for my son who was really struggling. And he walked right past me, pushed open the door, climbed into my son's bed and laid there until August was ready until August could like take deep breaths again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I, in that scene with Ace taking August's sock and like chewing on it and August being grossed out, because I feel like that's really important too.
Yeah.
Like he can hold this capacity for love and be fully human. And I think we're always moving back and forth between those. Yeah. It's a vision of the mustard plant. Mm-hmm. And it's also we're in the real world and this we all have our things, you know? So there was something else I was going to say, but I can't remember now.
Well, maybe it'll come back. I'm curious just in thinking about Ace's presence, because one of the things that you have done, you and Chris, your husband have done, is kind of insist that Ace be present, certainly in your family, mm-hmm. But also in school settings where that may and you're, I think, really gracious in the book in writing about how our school systems, when we talk about inclusion, we mean inclusion for a certain type of mm-hmm. child. And yet saying, no, that's actually what we're going to insist on. We're going to insist on Ace being present. And that his presence, again, is a gift that comes with some challenges. Let's not be pretending about that. So I'm just curious if you could speak about the ways in which Ace's presence, and you can choose where you want to go with this, in family, in school, in a church community, in friendships, has brought some of that different way of being into those spaces.
Yeah. It is such a challenge because public schools were built for a kind of student, a certain kind of student. And when kids with disabilities were finally welcomed in, which wasn't until the late 70s, the school systems have always been adjusting since then. But the system was not made for them. And so it's always a struggle, as you've experienced too, Amy Julia. Yeah. And there are a lot of challenges of advocating for him to be in spaces where it's hard for teachers and schools to see the value of it, because it requires so much more of staff and more creative thinking of what it means to teach kids who are learning at one level, mm-hmm. and also include kids who are learning at a different level. But some of the gifts that we have seen in that is just opening up other children's experience to seeing his value. I went to the color race at school, like back in October, and Ace is in third grade this year, and he's tiny. He's the size of a maybe kindergartner, maybe 4-year-old, and he was out there with all his third grade buddies. And at the color race, if your listeners haven't experienced this, like you run in a circle and people throw powder, colored powder on you. And hopefully you're wearing a white shirt and then your shirt's like all cute afterwards. And it's fun and silly. And so Ace got out there and he's sort of like, what is this? You know, what are we doing?
Right.
And he has a couple of buddies in the general ed class that we, you know, he's part of this general ed class in the morning and for art and for, he goes to Spanish and then he goes to special education classroom for part of the time. And then he goes back at the end of the day to the general ed classroom. So these kids know him, and I watched them kind of take turns running through this. It was a pretty small path for the color run. So one friend took him and they held hands, and Ace was still kind of trying to figure out what was going on. And some big kid came and cut him off, and Ace fell down. And the other kid who was with him, like, helped him stand back up, and they kept running together. And then he traded off and somebody else took Ace and ran the color run with him. And there was almost like a line for who was going to run with Ace through the kind of color run. And when I see that, I think about the way that I was formed by, I had a neighbor who had Down syndrome, who was in my grade all through elementary school, through high school. And she was on the volleyball team with me in elementary school, and we did brownies together.
Yeah.
And she shaped my understanding of disability, and I learned how to receive her presence, because I think that so many of us who don't grow up around disability, especially intellectual disability, don't know how to respond to a person.
Yeah.
And it's such a gift to offer to children. Yeah. And so I think getting to see those kids run the color race with Ace, and even to see that little boy who watched Ace get knocked down and then took the time to help him back up, or Ace was the bat boy for the Little League team last spring. Yeah. And he had to work hard to like figure out the notion of like going out and getting the bat and bringing it back. But he was really good at hanging it up. And his favorite part though was just hanging out in the dugout. Like, he loved being with his friends and watching them just talk to each other and sit and feel like he was part of it. And so, you know, I think that anytime my friend Heather Avis talks about how we're, any of us who are caring for a person with a disability are advocates, just like any person living with a disability is a self-advocate. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take doing some special task, like, you know, having a big Instagram account or having a job with an organization. It's showing up at the park with your child and insisting that they belong there, and showing up to school with this person you love who is not as easily received. And so living our lives as caregivers for a person with a disability is advocacy. And, you know, I feel that having him show up at the baseball game and seeing how these kids are being transformed. And sometimes people say, you know, he's just so cute, you know, it's kind of the response. And I've tended to think that most people just don't have the right word yet for what they're experiencing, because it really is, it's his presence. It's Like he envelops this invitation to the really real. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what I'm offering when I push for him to be in inclusive spaces.
Mm. So this is a little bit of a pivot, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on this. When Penny was young, I was kind of wrestling similarly to you with questions of like, what does it mean to be human? What is there about her experience that is different? Like I didn't want to flatten and say, oh, we're just the same, but I also, what are the things that are, that do tie our humanity together that I need to understand about her and about me? So asking all those questions. And a friend of mine said, you know, brokenness and limitations are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful for me because I think I had put them in the same category in my mind without knowing. And so I was seeing disability as brokenness. And I knew that wasn't right. Like but I couldn't figure out why it felt so tangled in my mind. Yeah. And so adding some distinction between brokenness and limitations was like really, really helpful for me. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that in terms of like, what do you think the difference is between brokenness and limitations? And where have you seen that in your life or in Ace's life? Are there things that you look at and you say, yeah, I think that might be like brokenness, not just limits? And in other places, other people might see this as brokenness, but it's really just limits, you know, and we haven't learned how to receive them yet. Yeah. So wherever you want to go with that, but I'd love to hear some of your thoughts.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is that each week at my church during confession, our pastor reminds us what sin is. And he always says, sin is cutting against the grain of love. And I think that that's what the difference is for me. It's like the world is broken in so much as like its systems cut against the grain of love. Systems have chosen power over love. Andy Crouch like uses the word mammon, and I talk about that a little in the book. And that word mammon he describes as the anti-God impetus that finds its power in money. And he calls it a will at work in history. And then he says it does this thing that allows us to experience power without relationship. And those are kind of the ways that I've started to think about what brokenness is. Like in this big sense of a broken world, that's what's going on. Like that it's cutting against the grain of love, whether that's like in systems that enact racial injustice or economic injustice or war. It's like this power at work in history and that's continuing into this moment and it leaks into our lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that when I participate in systems that oppress, which I do, you know, there are so many ways that we're always untangling the ways that we do. Yeah. But those are places where I'm choosing power over love. Mm-hmm. And I think limitations are something different where, you know, I think in the last few years, I've had to come to terms with some of my limitations, which, you know, several years ago, I had multiple concussions in a row and I have these debilitating migraines that come and I'm just kind of like, you know, I want to say useless, but that's not like, that's not helpful language. But I can't really participate in my life when they come. And, that is not brokenness. It's a limitation. It's brokenness when my frustration and anger that this has happened to me comes out in my relationships and I hurt people with my, with, you know, my lack of presence or my unkindness or, you know, I'm quick to anxiety. I have this anxiety diagnosis. That's a limitation, but my reaction if I allow it, and you know, this is tricky because I think there are times there's different ways of thinking about how mental health affects us, but there are times when I'm emotionally reactive and I'm not present because the anxiety has taken control. And when there are times that it becomes cutting against the grain of love.
That's what I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, when does it become brokenness? When I think it's when my limitations are reasons to hurt others, or when my pain leaks over into another person's life.
And reasons to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there can be brokenness in our own. I mean, I think you write about this actually a fair amount in this book. Like, that sense of not being willing to accept our own limitations is often its own brokenness, because what that means is we're constantly saying, I'm not good enough. And I just have to work harder in order to be okay, rather than understanding an inherent belovedness that comes not because of proving myself.
Yeah.
And I was really struck in the chapter called For the Ones Who Release Their Power, which is related to these ideas. You write, under God's reign on earth, love is not a squishy ideal. It's a way of being neighbors together. It's a way of living for the good of everyone. And the only way to accomplish that lofty goal is to reject our dependence on and submission to the power we've been taught to hoard for ourselves. And I was so struck by your use of the word dependence on power, because I think I tend to think about dependence on self as a contrast to depending on God, rather than depending on power. But I think that's helpful, because, and what I also want to say here is I think that the only power that God ever chooses to wield is the power of love. And that's a really non-coercive, gentle, patient, kind power, but it is powerful. Like, it's actually there. That's the really real, right? Is that, like, this is a power, but it's incredibly different than the power of the world. And so there's a sense of, we are going to be dependent upon a power, whether that is the power of mammon or the power of love. And it's not ever quite going to be myself. Like, I'm going to be kind of caught up in that. And I just really appreciated that meditation really on power and what it looks like for us to be dependent upon the power of love rather than the power of mammon, which I think is related to what you were just saying.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, you wrote so beautifully about this in White Picket Fences, like that dependence on power is so clearly evident for those of us who are reckoning with our own white privilege. And we have grown up connected to this power that has come easily for us, and recognizing our dependence on it is a hard, it's a difficult thing to see. And then you start to see it, and then you realize you need to start, like, you know, unprying your fingers from it, because you know what I'm saying?
No, I do. I mean, I think that is you write, this is a quotation about mammon. All of us who have lived subject to mammon have been trained to question the humanity of my son, even if we're too polite to say it out loud. I mean, there's in terms of just the nefarious effects of clinging to that power, that actually distorts love and corrupts love, I mean, in our own lives and all around us. And we see that, I think, in, there's in just a multitude of different ways.
I think there's that sense of when we believe, I mean, it's this holy, like, foundational sense of, like, it's ableism at its core is kind of how we've been taught to live our lives, especially those of us who are achievers and who can, like, earn the praise of others by what we do. And we're told over and over that what we do is what gives us worth, even if no one says it. That's how I got all my awards, you know, in high school. The harder I worked, the nicer I was, the more that I joined clubs, the more I got the, like, best girl awards. And it is this undercurrent that tells us we're good when we perform. And then, like, you know, for me, coming to terms with what that means and how I've been living my life. It's the opposite of how I want the world to see Ace. And I've had to change how I believe, what I believe about myself and what makes me good. Because if my goodness is dependent on what I can do, achieve, or even how good I can be, mm-hmm. how happy I can make God with me, then I am missing the core of what Ace has to give the world.
Well, and this I think is related because I'm thinking about, you know, we just recently this, I guess, winter and spring renamed this podcast, Reimagining mm-hmm. the Good Life. And so I want to ask two questions related to the name of the podcast, but also to the work you're doing as we kind of come to a close here. So the first is the good life, which you've just been talking about. But in the past, what would you say you understood the good life to be? And how has your experience with ACE and studying the Beatitudes changed it?
I have to say that I was very happy with your name change. And I think it's just right on point. Yeah, I think one of the things I'm grateful for is that I think my idea of the good life has always been a spiritual, like my own understanding of a spiritual wholeness. I think my parents modeled for me the gift mm-hmm. of a simple life. I never had this like, I will be happy if I can just get rich. Mm-hmm. I will be happy if I'm a very successful fill in the blank. My mom was a teacher. My dad like was an architect who did small things in a small city. Yeah. And that idea of like loving your community, your family, loving God, like those are things that were really beautiful about how I was raised. And I think I also have had to work to separate that notion from perfection.
Yeah.
Like, because it was still like, how good can you be at this like small life? And in childhood, I caught on really fast to the fact that adults thought I was good at being a lover of God. It was like my natural tendency. And so I found my identity in that even as a little girl and struggled with this idea that I could make some kind of dramatic mark in the world for Jesus, that I would finally like land on a life that was good enough for God to love it, for God to give that seal of approval. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in my 20s, I started kind of kicking off the burden of my early understanding of faith. I was questioning everything. I was sort of like I don't believe in a God who is like waiting for me to be perfect so that God can love me. But I knew I still always had this like, someday I'll reach it. Someday I'll like get there. And then I'll finally like find what this good life, this like, I didn't have the language of the whole life. But it still was around this idea of I would finally get it right myself. Mm. I think that having kids in my 30s and also that decade was spent far from all of our family. So I was raising them, you know, fairly alone. And I think that really knocked the, like, I'm finally going to get there. Someday I'll get there idea. Like, I think the relentlessness and just the monotony of the ordinary and what I felt were my constant parenting failures. I think I started to kind of like grow this new notion of like God shaping my ordinary life into something good outside of my achievements. And I think now in my 40s, I'm settling more into that. Like, you know, my older kids now can tell me how I failed them, and they do sometimes. And that's not fun. But I think I'm living more fully in the idea that what makes life good is not perfection.
Yeah.
That this life is always going to ache. And, you know, that idea of the kingdom of God is only the mustard seed right now. And we wish it were the whole plant.
Yeah.
But like the really real is here in the present. It's not this moment that I'm going to finally develop all the wisdom that I need to have. It's not going to come into completion in this like perfect way. I'm just going to keep aching and keep growing. And that like that movement toward wholeness is the good life. It's that process.
Mm, I love that. That movement towards wholeness is the good life. I've one other thought for you, which is just the idea of the imagination. So part of what I mean when I say reimagining the good life is exactly what you just described, kind of recognizing what culture, whether that's kind of Christian culture or secular culture, tells you is the good life, and then saying, hold on, is that really true? But then also I really have been considering like what is the spiritual imagination? Like how can we use something like the Beatitudes as a guide to reimagining? And I think for me, especially, and for you too, like reimagining not just the good life in a general sense, but the good life for a family that includes children who are not typical, right? Mm-hmm. Like what does that look like? So I don't know. I just thought, would love to hear your thoughts about using the imagination. I think the dream of God is related to that. Mm-hmm. The ways in which Jesus might have been inviting us to use our imaginations in speaking the Beatitudes, through his teaching in general. But like, what does it mean to you to reimagine the good life in general or in particular?
Mm. Yeah, well, I think Jesus was absolutely always inviting people to use their imaginations. That's the way he taught, was in story. Imagination is how we envision a different world. So if we want to believe that it's possible for there to be a world where mammon is not in charge, where those systems of oppression are not the things that have the power, then like it's our imagination that's going to take us there. I think that the spiritual life is meant to be like a dance between our thinking minds and our imaginative minds and our bodies. And so often we keep it in our thinking minds. Mm. But I think when Jesus told us stories, like he was living out all of those things. And yeah, I'm really thankful that you're thinking about the good life in terms of reimagination, because I think imagination is really the most underutilized tool in the church. Mm. And I think it's kind of the beginning of transformation. Mm-hmm. Like we can dream of what could be, and then we use our thinking minds and our bodies to move towards that vision.
I love that. And I think it's so interesting, at least I think for the two of us, the ways in which God has given us people to help in exactly that that reimagining. And I love what you're saying. It's yes, you've got this dream or vision, which again, that idea of imagination as an image, mm-hmm. right? Like something you can see that maybe has not been called into existence yet, but it's still kind of visible in some way. But living into that with our thinking minds, but also with our bodies. And, mm-hmm. I really appreciate those thoughts. I really feel like I've asked you about maybe half of the questions I would want to ask about this book, because there's, a lot of real richness there. And, so hopefully what that means is that people who've listened to this conversation will go buy the book and will enjoy it. And I'm sure I've said this already in the introduction that I haven't actually recorded yet. But in that, I will also commend people to find your Slow Way newsletter, because mm-hmm. I am a regular subscriber and love it.
Thank you.
You get those weekly emails, and a lot of them I delete, but I never delete yours because I always want to read it. So we can point people towards that and towards the Lucky Few podcast, but especially towards Blessed Are the Rest of Us, because it's a beautiful book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, as always, for listening to this episode of Reimagining the Good Life. please take a second to rate or review it, to share it with others, and don't forget to subscribe. You can get email updates, learn about more details related to the Reimagining Family Life with Disability workshop. And please reach out to me if you have thoughts, feedback, ideas about this podcast. My email is amyjuliabeckerwriter@gmail.com. I want to conclude by thanking Jake Hansen for editing this podcast and Amber Beery, my social media coordinator, for doing everything else to make sure it happens. As we go into our day today, I hope this conversation helps you to challenge assumptions, proclaim belovedness, and envision a world of belonging. Let's reimagine the good life together.